I was asked by the organizers to talk about Susie breaking and string theory. I guess they don't trust me to pick my own topic. So, okay. This is actually a huge subject, obviously. People have worked on Susie breaking in and out of string theory for 27 years. What I mean by Susie breaking, of course, non-supersymmetric physics has been dominant since physics was done. I'm going to start with old stuff, which means papers that are based on ideas that were generated before I was in the field. Dynamical supersymmetry breaking and field theory, what the basic notion is. I'll go through what I consider to be the simplest models that don't in their original incarnation do dynamical supersymmetry breaking, but in modern language they might. And then I'll discuss sort of where this went in the 90s up to recent developments of things like ISS, which is models that in non-abelian gauge theory that dynamically break supersymmetry. I'll try to go through that quickly. String theory doesn't add anything here. It's just to give you an idea of where the field is. Then I'll talk about the promotion to string theory or supergravity of these kinds of ideas. And this will be a very short section. I'll tell you what the basic scales are that you want to work with in the F terms and superpotentials. And I'll talk about new problems. And I think, frankly, what the promotion of these ideas to string theory does is really just introduce a lot of new problems. The main problem is some kind of version of the Dein-Seiberg problem from the mid-80s, and we'll describe that. And then I'll sort of change tacks and describe new ideas for Susie breaking that seem natural or elementary, the sort of first things you think of to break supersymmetry in string theory, that don't necessarily tie into to where this has gone, but they seem dual or different, but very simple from the perspective of D-brains and geometry. So I'll talk about stringy Susie breaking via geometry and brains. And then, if I haven't really run out of time, I'll talk about Susie breaking from string instantons as opposed to field theory instantons. Okay, and since this is supposed to be a review talk and there are a number of sort of different subjects, I wanted to start by just telling you what my philosophy is about this subject. Okay, what's my take? So my take is the following. If Susie is relevant at all in particle physics, which we'll find out soon, maybe, then we know that M Susie breaking in any model without large extra dimensions or something is some scale exponentially below the string scale. Okay? So the question in this subject is how you generate naturally in a supersymmetric theory a scale exponentially lower than the string scale where Susie breaks. And there are sort of two natural ideas for generating such small scales. One is strong dynamics, and the other is non-perturbative or instanton effects, which can sometimes occur even in a calculable and weakly coupled theory. And my take on the subject is, of course, these are qualitatively old ideas, but string theory does add something new to both. For strong dynamics, one thing it adds is gauge gravity duality or general ideas of geometric engineering. And so there may be things that we can see using the gravitational perspective that wouldn't be obvious to a field theorist staring at the same field theory at weak coupling. Okay, and that will be what I talk about in part three. And in part four, string theory offers new non-perturbative effects. Even in low energy gauge theories that don't do anything interesting, stringy Euclidean brains can modify the gauge theory in an interesting way. Okay, in ways that aren't really just dependent on Yang-Mills instantons, but some of the new instantons in string theory. And that, I think, might change our perspective in section four on which kinds of simple models could lead to low-energy Susie breaking. So that's where we're going to be going. But before I get to any string theory, I will review the really basic ideas from field theory to try and put the whole thing in some kind of perspective. And please interrupt with questions. So I'm going to start with the basic ideas, in case any of you haven't paid attention at all to what goes on in Susie model building. So the basic idea in this subject is dynamical Susie breaking. Okay, what does this mean? Here's the sketch of the idea. If you have a four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetric theory, then the low-energy physics is always governed by an effective Lagrangian. Well, that's an overstatement, but aside from some exotic fixed points, we know effective Lagrangians. And it takes the form of the following sort. There are 4 theta coordinates in n equals 1 superspace, and there are 3 functions you need to specify to give the action. There's a Kähler potential, a superpotential, and a gauge coupling function. So this looks like f of phi, delta w alpha. Okay, so what are the objects I've introduced here? Phi is some schematic representation of all the chiral superfields in my problem. So it has a lowest component that's a complex scalar, Fermi partner, and so forth. W alpha is the field strength superfield. It starts with the Gaugino, and so forth. So this term gives you the Yang-Mills kinetic term. And so this function f, you should think of as being the 1 over g squared of the group, which generally depends on the expectation values of different chiral fields. Okay. And the important thing here is that while the Kähler potential, which governs kinetic terms, is integrated over all of superspace, it's integrated d4 theta, these two functions w and f are holomorphic and integrated over half of superspace. Now, there's a non-renormalization theorem proved in the late 70s using supergraph techniques by Gates et al. Not Gates et al. Grisaru et al. And this non-renormalization theorem says, under a wide variety of circumstances, the superpotential is some tree-level superpotential that in field theory you just choose, you write down, plus terms that are of order e to the minus 1 over g squared, exponentially small terms if you have some gauge group with coupling g. Okay. There's a similar theorem for f that says f is tree level plus one loop plus non-perturbative. Now, because of this non-renormalization theorem, there's a great idea, which I think occurred to lots of people, but it's most clearly explained in a paper of Witten's. And this is the following. So v, the potential as a function of these scalar fields in the global field theory, takes this form. And if there were gauge groups, then there can be D terms too. They won't matter for me. And Suzy is unbroken. If V is 0 in the minimum, which means if dw equals 0. So fi, which are dw d phi I, equals 0, then Suzy is unbroken. Now, if you start with a theory that at tree level has a superpotential that allows you to solve these equations, to all orders in perturbation theory, that will remain true, okay, unless some terrible singularity happens in the metric or something. But under regular circumstances, to all orders in perturbation theory, there will be a Suzy vacuum. But what could be true is that the order e to the minus 1 over g squared effects lead to vacua where dw is not 0, either by lifting the Suzy vacua or giving vacua elsewhere in field space. Now, because of the non-renormalization theorem, this is a totally reasonable thing to have happen. Okay, something exponentially small could be the leading effect that breaks supersymmetry. And then, if that was true, you expect the scale of the F terms to be of order e to the minus 1 over g squared. And the nice thing about this is, for instance, it's naturally far below M Planck for the same reason that the QCD scale is naturally far below M Planck. If g is a fifth, you get a huge hierarchy. So the basic philosophy governing this field has been, if you really believe supersymmetry has something to do with the hierarchy problem in particle physics, you look for models where non-perturbative effects lead to Suzy breaking. Now, it is not easy, or at least it was not easy in the early days, to write down such models. It looks a lot easier today than it did then. And in fact, Witten's original paper had no examples. So now what I'm going to do is write down simple models. And we'll come back to these at the end. And and see how they may actually realize, in some cases, Witten's idea. But to begin with, these are just the first models people wrote down, and they look like they aren't examples of this idea. So here's the first model that anyone would write down if you asked them to make something that breaks Susie. In this case, anyone was Polonyi. And so, okay, we need to have some fields. If there are no fields, we're not going to break Susie. So let's have a single chiral field X. We want X to have an F term. F is the derivative of the superpotential. So let's give it canonical kinetic terms. And let's just set W to be linear. And by dimensional analysis, there should be a mu squared in front where mu has dimensions of mass. Well, so naively at least, okay, fx is now going to be like mu squared. Maybe there's the dagger there. Which means, naively at least, you'd have Susie breaking and a potential, which would be of order mu to the fourth. Now, this is too naive in many ways. First of all, we see that the potential doesn't depend on x at all. And x has a scalar field in it. So there's a moduli space, a vacua, for arbitrary values of x. It looks like you have this F term. That's obviously not going to survive if the theory had any kind of interaction. But the other problem is this theory, in fact, is not interacting. Okay, this is too simple a theory. And if you go and work out the spectrum, what you'd find is that mx is 0. In fact, its Fermi partner is also massless. There has to be a massless fermion if Susie is breaking spontaneously, because there has to be a Goldsteiner. So although this kind of looked like it should break Susie, it's a free theory, and it's a free theory with a massless scalar and fermion. Now, this is a fake, because in any real theory, I mean, in string theory, you never have a single field X. You all have hundreds of fields. But also, you never really have something that's totally non-interacting. Nothing else gravitational would induce higher interactions. And what's true in this theory is that this pseudo-moduli space of expectation values of X will be lifted by any field. So of course, people realized this early on. They considered what would happen in supergravity, and they wrote down the most sort of generic kind of correction you could expect. Since superpotentials tend to be robust, this is a free theory to start with, so it certainly doesn't have strong non-perturbative dynamics that will change the superpotential. But the most obvious thing to do is just write down the corrections to k. So if, for instance, k goes to k plus delta k, where in some expansion around the origin, maybe that would be x dagger x, then from phase symmetries, maybe you would get an x term that looks like x dagger x squared. Well, that term has too high a dimension to appear with no mass scale, so there has to be a high mass scale. This could be the mass scale of some object that interacted with x that you integrated out to correct the Kähler potential. Well, if you include this correction, okay, so c is some number, then you'll find that the metric on moduli space is now a little more non-trivial. Looks like this. So if you re-expand your potential for the x field at small x, because secretly there are powers of the Kähler metric entering in the correct potential, you'll find that v from this correction would get some x dependence, which, hopefully I got the signs right, would look like this. So we learned something interesting. Any kind of high energy physics will induce corrections to k, and you have a 50-50 shot of this silly theory breaking supersymmetry. It's 50-50 because if c has the wrong sign, if c is positive, this potential slopes off to large x. Then you should re-expand the theory at some large x close to this cutoff, and we don't know what happens. But if c is negative, there's a vacuum exactly where we expanded the theory at 0. So for c less than 0, there's a stable Susie breaking vacuum, and the x field is massive. While its Fermi partner remains a Goldsteiner. And so this becomes a real example of spontaneous Susie breaking for frequency greater than zero, this is sort of just a runaway. You have to re-expand, and we don't know what happens. Now, this would be great. This would be everything we ordered, except because this theory is free and has no interesting dynamics, we had to stick this parameter mu into the theory by hand. We're allowed to do that in supersymmetry because it doesn't get renormalized. But to get a very small Susie breaking scale, then, if we want a mu squared much less than a Planck squared, it looks like we would have to just insert a tiny, tiny parameter into the Lagrangian. Okay. So Witten's idea was precisely to avoid doing this. And this example looks like it's not going to work. You could call it technically natural. But it's still kind of disgusting. We'll see that most of the fancier ideas that came 25 years after this at very low energy is actually reduced to this idea, okay, where the mu squared is induced by high energy. Okay, there's one more simple model I want to describe. I'll describe this one quickly. It's the relative that you get when you include D terms. So that gives another simple model that shows up in the other half of Susie breaking models at low energy. So let's take a gauge group now, which is U1. And let's take some matter fields. The simplest content to avoid anomalies is the specular-like pair, phi plus and phi minus, of charge plus minus. And the lowest gauge invariant superpotential we can write down is then a mass, m phi plus phi minus. Now, because G is U1, only for U1, there's the possibility of a phi Eliopoulos D term, which is, you could just take the auxiliary field and the gauge multiplets and write this in the Lagrangian. It wouldn't be gauge invariant because the adjoint transforms under most gauge groups, but for U1, it's gauge invariant. So with the canonical K, you can then write out the potential. You get something that looks, from the superpotential, like a sum of squares, constraining both phi plus and phi minus. And then from the D term, if E is the gauge coupling, you get something like this. So if you look for Susie vacua, you will fail to find any for generic values of the parameters. You see that, remember, V has to be zero for a Susie breaking, sorry, for a supersymmetric vacuum, because you can write it as a sum of supercharges. But we would need M phi plus to be zero and M phi minus to be zero to kill these two terms. But then we need phi plus squared minus phi minus squared to be R. And so as long as R is non-zero, and it's allowed, so why shouldn't it be, then you break Susie. So and you can write down where the vacuum is, at least if you give yourself some large or small parameter to play with. So for instance, for large R, R is dimensionful. What do I mean? I mean, in the analysis, large means bigger than m squared over e squared. You can write down the vacuum. The vacuum basically saturates the D term. And so you get phi plus squared, basically being R, phi minus basically being zero, and f of phi minus being m root r. One nice thing about this model, unlike the Polonyi model, is that it has a stable Susie breaking vacuum right away without considering higher corrections. Another nice thing about it is in the limit r goes to infinity with m root r fixed, you can consider any limit you want. This is field theory. This actually is the Polonyi model. So what happens is the high energy interactions of the Higgs V1 induces the correction of the K-Or potential in the Polonyi model that stabilizes its vacuum. And you can decouple the higher energy degrees of freedom and recover that model with a stable vacuum.
Are you putting out RF for that same kind of reason?
I'm leaving out RF for that same kind of reason. Also, I have only 90 minutes. OK, now again, this is nice enough, but G is U1, So there's no strong dynamics. This theory doesn't even exist. And well, M and R are parameters that we chose by hand, but in a real theory, we might think that they're both of order M Planck. And so this theory, while very nice and simple, does not exhibit dynamical supersymmetry breaking. But just as this reduces to that in some limit, we'll see the DSP models typically reduce to this or this. Okay, so the point there was, any idiot can easily write down Suzy breaking models, but the fancy thing is to get them where the dimensionful parameters are naturally very small compared to M Planck. So how did people do this? So for years there was somehow lore that this was very hard, but after people really understood the dynamics of Suzy QCD properly, based on work of Seiberg, it became clear that it's not that hard to make models that dynamically break supersymmetry. So there's this large literature from the 80s that you can basically ignore now. Let me give you the two simplest examples. Okay, one is the Ozawa-Yanagita Introligator Thomas model. The hardest thing about it is just the name. Okay, so let's take Suzy QCD. So there's some gauge group, SUNC, for the number of colors. And we can consider various numbers of quark multiplets. So for illustrative purposes, I'll work with SU2. That's the first case where there's really non-abelian dynamics, so you can help for dimensional transmutation. And we'll take the case where NF equals NC is the number of quarks. So normally, there would be then two Q tilde fields and two Q fields, all in the fundamental. For SU2, the doublet happens to be a real representation, and so there are four doublet chiral multiplets. Okay. So what does this theory do? Well, to begin with just this content and no superpotential, it has a five-dimensional moduli space of vacua. You take 4 times 2 and subtract the 3 gauge bosons, there's some Higgs branch, where SU2 is generically broken. And at the origin, SU2 is restored. One of the interesting things Seiberg realized is that quantum mechanically, in fact, like with Seiberg-Witten theory, there's no point on the moduli space of this theory where SU2 is restored. That's a dynamical effect, and so there will be a small number that enters in it. So let's find Vij to be these gauge invariants that you can make out of the doublets. So these give coordinates on the moduli space. There's a classical moduli space, and it's described in these coordinates by the identity that the Pfaffian of V, just using classical identities, is 0. So there are 6 complex Vs, there's 1 complex constraint that gives you the moduli space. And this is just an identity on classical variables. Now the thing that Seiberg derived in various different ways, by requiring that when you add masses, you get a Guilino condensate in the appropriate way or whatever, is that quantum mechanically, this moduli space is deformed. We now understand that you can derive this from a Beasley-Witten type of instanton effect, but he didn't use that. And it becomes Pfaffian of V equals the only thing with dimensions in this game, the scale of SU2 to the fourth. Some thing that's naturally going to be exponentially small if the SU2 coupling is a little bit weak at very high energies. So we can mock this up with a superpotential. We can add a Lagrange multiplier and say this theory has this superpotential. Now, Introligator and Thomas and Ozawa and Yanagita had the following idea. Let's consider adding some field content that makes the doublets want to live at the origin, which they could have done classically, but which quantum mechanically has been removed from the moduli space. Then the classical superpotential, which wants them to live at the origin, will conflict with this, but that conflict will be an order lambda thing. And so any breaking that results from that will be an order lambda effect, and hence exponentially small. So they very elegantly added 6 singlets to the theory. Let's call them Sij. M considered a total superpotential that included not just the Stoffian constraint, but the natural coupling of the S's to the V's, which is some lambda tilde Sij Vij. Okay, you're free to do this. Again, it's field theory. You can do anything you want. You could ask how natural it is not to have higher order terms in the singlets. There are certain U1 and other global symmetries that make this not as ridiculous as it sounds. Okay, so what happens? Well, clearly this term will tell you that the F terms of the S fields want V to vanish. So Fs tells you that V is zero. Sorry, tells you that Vij is zero. But the constraint from the Lagrange multiplier tells you that not all the V's can vanish. And so you conclude that there is Suzy breaking. Now, this is too quick. It's possible that there's no supersymmetric vacuum, but the thing just runs away. And in fact, this model is a little bit on the dangerous edge. Okay, you can analyze it in various limits. For instance, let's imagine we expand around singlet bevs, where lambda tilde S is small. Small compared to what? Compared to lambda, the only other dimensionable thing. And let's imagine that we sit on the SO5 globally symmetric point. What do I mean by that? There's the four doublets. They have a global symmetry. It would have been restored completely if their bevs vanish. Their bevs can't vanish on the quantum moduli space, but they can get pretty close. They can reach points where they have an SO5 symmetry.
So the global symmetry starts as SO4, right? Now you act on the Vs.
It actually becomes SO6, yeah.
Why does it become SO6?
You can actually rotate the Vs into each other.
So you're assuming that this is enhanced?
Well, I think that is just actually symmetry of the problem.
You start with SU.
SU4 is SO6.
Complex.
Yeah, but remember the doublet is a special representation. There's an SO6 global symmetry to start with. Okay. So with small values of that lambda S, okay, you can just write down what the superpotential looks like. It looks like this. So what I've done here is, at the SO5 point, break up the six mesons into a 5 and a singlet. The singlet has a bev and sources this linear term for S naught. The 5 couples to the 5 in the 6 splitted S's. And what we see that this model is it's a Polanyi model. Okay, all that's happening here is these fields are massive, and the S naught field is the Polanyi field X. So the IYIT model is a dressed up version of a Polanyi model. Unfortunately, it has the same disease as the Polanyi model. At least in the IT paper, they concluded that the potential for S naught was incalculable. Now, actually, I think later work contradicted this, found ways to compute with various assumptions about the parameters, and found a stable vacuum. But at this level, the model has a flat direction S naught that could run off to infinity. It wouldn't matter in the sense that there'd still be Suzy breaking and splittings. But they didn't actually pin down the vacuum. Okay, so that's the first kind of simple model that comes out of the revolutions of the 90s. The second kind, that's even simpler in some sense, is the ISS models, which came out a couple of years ago. So let's consider, again, Suzy QCD. And let's consider it now in the regime, not where NF is NC, which we considered there, If NF is less than NC, the theory has a superpotential that causes it to run away, so that's not a good place to look either. So let's look at NF greater than NC. But let's look at it, numbers of flavors less than 3/2 NC. We look at these regions of parameter space because Seiberg was able to show that in this range, there's an infrared-free magnetic description. And so we're pretty confident that if we make some claim about this theory, we can check it using the duality. So what is Seiberg duality going to tell us about these theories? It tells us that the SUNC theory with NF flavors QI, QI tilde in the N and N bar representation, and with mesons MIJ, which are just the gauge invariants you can make out of their product, is the same in the sense of infrared equivalence, not at high energies, to a different gauge theory, that with SUNF minus NC gauge group. Now, the global symmetry that acts on these quarks is an exact symmetry of the theory that had better really be present also in any dual description. So you better have NF flavors of quarks, QI and QI tilde. And these mesons here actually become a meson here that you just add as a fundamental field. This MIJ is a gauge singlet, but it transforms under the flavor group that rotates the quarks. And so you get the unique renormalizable superpotential that couples these things, which is MIJ, QI, Q tilde J. That preserves the flavor symmetries. Now, because secretly we like to think in electric variables and identify the meson with this bilinear, if you do dimension counting carefully and want to keep track of scales, it's probably best to say this M would be divided by a lambda, because it's really secretly a quark bilinear. And then you can define a new canonical field phi to be M over lambda. Okay, so this is the magnetic theory. There's some huge amount of evidence from field theory and string theory and all kinds of cross-checks that these theories are truly infrared equivalent. Now, the great insight of 2006 is that instead of just studying the theory with no superpotential and comparing moduli spaces, we can consider adding a small mass. So let's perturb the electric theory, the one I started with, by a small quark mass.
Is that dynamically small?
I'll talk about it in a second. Okay, and in fact, what do we mean by small? Again, there's only one scale in the problem lambda, so this M should be small compared to lambda. Hence Eva's evil question, which is, we're gonna dynamically generate something because lambda is naturally small, but we're inputting a parameter at tree level that's smaller than the dynamical parameter. Doesn't that suck? Okay, and then we need to go back and try to explain why this is small. That will introduce another sector that makes this small, and this is... Well, we're going to do that by the end. It would relieve all the dramatic tension if I just did that first and then stopped the talk. Okay, so W tree is an equal mass for all the quarks. Here it is. Now, in the magnetic theory, this maps to what you'd guess. The meson is MII is QI Q tilde I. So W magnetic will then be equal to the phi Q Q tilde coupling that I had already written, plus the sum on I M lambda phi I. So now we get in this magnetic theory where we'll actually do everything, and which lives in a regime where we trust the classical analysis based on the superpotential near the origin because it's weakly interacting. We can just minimize dW magnetic d phi. And we'll see that it's q qi q tilde j plus m lambda delta ij. And now we can already declare victory because since this matrix with I and j indices is being made out of a product of vectors, it has an anomalously low rank. It'll have rank nf minus nc, which is the rank of the magnetic gauge group. But this thing clearly has rank nf. In fact, it would have even if I didn't choose equal masses, but just enough non-zero eigenvalues of the mass matrix. Something with rank nf minus nc cannot possibly cancel something with rank nf, and so SUSY is broken. You see here, this is again related to Eva's complaint, this is a beautiful system, but in fact, the breaking here is a purely classical effect with a small parameter put in by hand.
Not Susie.
Yeah, not Susie. Right. Okay. Now, this tells us that phi is going to have an F term for sure. In some of its components, it's a big matrix, and that will break Susie. Now there is a complicated moduli space in this theory to start with, and well, before you added the masses at least. And even with the SUSY breaking, just like with the Polonyi model, there is a space of flat directions at tree level. Okay, so there's a pseudo-moduli space that minimizes the potential. Which looks like this. I'm not gonna go through the detailed derivations, but I'll just write it out for those of you who really like to know where the vacuum lives. Okay, so what is this? This is a big matrix that's NF by NF. This is an NF minus NC by NF minus NC block. This is an NC by NC block, because the total number of rows is NF. And similarly here, the Q naught is in the first entries, and the zero is in the second set of entries. So the quarks and phi take VEVs in opposite pieces of their index space. And as long as the Qs satisfy one equation, the QQ tilde is M lambda times the identity NF minus NC by NF minus NC, you get a vacuum. So that analysis is just doing classical matrix algebra, so I'm not going to go through it. The scale of SUSY breaking is M lambda. So you see, even if M had been huge, if you could have trusted this analysis, you'd still get a small scale of SUSY breaking. Unfortunately, if M is huge, the analysis is wrong. And you can show that this sort of pseudo-moduli space actually gets destabilized as you take M large compared to lambda. Okay.
Now, it doesn't really get destabilized before.
Sorry?
There's some interacting theory and there's some dynamics, and you think that because you've broken SUSY, that the pseudo-moduli space is not really flat any longer.
No, good. So what really happens here, okay, first, I'm not gonna go through it in much detail, but first of all, you do this sort of Coleman-Weinberg analysis. Okay, so one loop, the pseudo-moduli are lifted, but they weave a space of degenerate solutions, and that space of degenerate solutions is Goldstone bosons. So those remain there. Now, when you couple to gravity and break the global symmetries, those would get lifted too. Okay? So all non-Goldstones, Goldstones, I guess I should call them non-Bouvons. Anyway, all the things that aren't related to spontaneous breaking of global symmetries are lifted. The moduli space of the Goldstones that remains exactly is a coset G mod H that's compact. G is SUNF cross U1 baryon. And H is the subgroup that's preserved on the pseudo moduli space, which is SUNF minus NC times SUNC times U1. Okay, so there's some nice intricate story here. But the beautiful fact is, G just taking the one supersymmetric theory we understood best that's not abelian, Suzy QCD, as soon as you understood the dynamics, it gets quantum deformed for NF equals NC. It has a dual for NF greater than NC. For NF less than NC, it runs away, so you can't talk about it. But in all the regimes where it exists, you can do stupid things to it to get Suzy breaking at a low scale. Okay, that's good. It means it's not so hard to get DSB in field theory. Now, there are also NC Suzy vacua in this theory that I haven't talked about. That should be obvious to you, because in the electric theory, below the scale of the mass, I have pure glue. The pure glue theory is going to have a Gugino condensate and spontaneous breaking of B1R symmetry that leads to N vacua. So those are here, but they're far away from these non-Suzy vacua. And the vacua we found are metastable if the small parameter that we needed is small. So the same thing that stabilizes the pseudomoduli small m also makes the vacua metastable. Now, this looked completely classical the way I've described it, because I did classical manipulations of the magnetic theory, but the duality is highly quantum mechanical. It doesn't work without quantum mechanical effects. And so in the electric theory, this is DSB. Okay. Now, I could go through many, many other examples, but I think these are sort of emblematic of where the field has come. Okay, you solve a supersymmetric theory, whatever dynamics it has, you can then add a small tree level term to play off against that and give you a Suzy breaking vacuum.
From it?
Yeah.
Is the lesson here, whenever you have a duality, you can do something simple and classical in one and then transform it back and claim to have some big...
Yes. Yes. I mean, we'll do more of that in the string theory, too. I mean, the good question is, in which of these models is it not true that you input some small parameter by hand? And in string theory, we'll see right now that this problem gets much dicier because, unlike in field theory, although in string theory you can do a landscape's worth of things, they're still discrete. So, okay. So, what do I want to do now? Very quickly, I want to transition, and so we're going to promote ourselves to string theory and see what new headaches arise. Okay, and the first thing to say is, and I'll make this clear in a second, but at the level we've talked about these models, none of them would work in string theory for a very clear reason that I'll explain. But first, let's do some scales, because that will explain one of the main things we have to understand. So here's the supergravity potential. It looks a lot like the field theory one I wrote down. You sum over chiral multiplets Fi squared. There's a correction due to supergravity, which is the minus 3W squared term that's so famous. Now, in flat space, which is where we're going to end up living by data, basically flat space, we know that W is then set by the Suzy breaking scale. If we want to live in flat space, and we know the scale at which Suzy broke, we know the value of W. This is interesting. What is the value that we seem to see? It depends a little bit on how you mediate the Suzy breaking to the standard model.
You're forgetting about D terms, just
because. I'm forgetting about D terms, just for simplicity. They wouldn't change what I'm about to say. So, if you mediate to the standard model as weakly as we think you could possibly do, all that gravity mediation means is by Planck-suppressed interactions. Okay, if nothing else communicates to the standard model, Planck-suppressed interactions will, then a relatively large Suzy breaking in some hidden sector would be diluted by gravity. That would result in F terms that are about 10 to the 11 GeV squared, the famous intermediate scale. The calculation you do here is F squared over M Planck squared should be a TeV. Okay, you get the intermediate scale out of that. What this means is that W is going to be 10 to the minus 16 in its natural units. If you do gauge mediation, which is good for flavor and also good for wishful thinking because you might see signs of it at the OHC, then a typical W, well, a typical F term would be like 10 squared TeV for the people who like low-scale gauge mediation. And then the typical W you'd get would be like 10 to the minus 28 in Planck units. So there is a new small number that you have to explain once you start taking gravity seriously. This is related to the cosmological constant, but not in some dramatic way. I'm not trying to get a small cosmological constant to 100 decimal places. Just trying to get order of magnitude flat space. So to get the leading decimals to cancel, you see that there's a small parameter in the theory, and so you must explain both small f and small w. And there's a good idea, which is R symmetry, because the superpotential rotates under an R symmetry. And so if there's an approximate R symmetry in nature, it could explain why the superpotential naturally has a small expectation value in vacuum. Okay, but the new problems are where most of the fun lies, beyond just the low scales. The new problem is the following. All parameters that I talked about in the DSB theory become fields when we promote them to string theory. They depend on moduli of the extra dimensions. The gauge couplings are determined by the dilaton or by volumes of cycles. The mass terms are determined by values of complex structure or distances between brains. So everything is dynamical. And so when we go through and minimize the superpotential to find out whether we've broken supersymmetry or not, we forgot to minimize with respect to a bunch of the parameters. So for instance, just to talk about ISS, here was our potential. Okay, in field theory, this is a glorious success of Susie breaking. In string theory, what this does is takes m to 0 and lambda to 0, and typically the Calabi-Yau decompactifies. Okay, so this is the zeroth order problem. You can do anything you want in field theory, but the parameters will be promoted to fields in string theory. And until you decide how you're going to fix m and lambda, and not just the devs of the quarks and mesons, you have not written down a model that you can couple to string theory and quantum gravity and claim has broken supersymmetry.
So you can tell us how to fix the moduli.
Yeah, so all I was going to say in this part is this clearly ties to moduli fixing. For the rest of the talk, I'll actually just work on non-compact gravitational examples, but any really honest attempt to make a model, you have to really imagine that you're going to fix m and lambda, or whatever the analogous parameters are in the models I come up with. Okay? And there's a huge literature about that already, but that would be a separate 90-minute talk. And I don't have time for it today. So, given that we encounter this issue immediately, instead of spending all my time describing how you would make SUSY QCD in string theory and try to embed these models there, which anyway would probably not teach us so much, I'm instead going to switch subjects now and say, imagine I'm a string theorist and I've never read the papers by Witten and by Seiberg, but I just have, you know, I have Joe's theory in front of me with D-brains and stuff, and I want to break SUSY. What do I do? Are they the same things? Are they dual? So here are some of the ideas that people have discussed in the last few years. And probably a dominant theme has been that one should somehow geometrize field theory dynamics, including the geometry of SUSY breaking. So the slogan, it's the same slogan you get in ADS QCD and in ADS CMT and ADS everything else. So it's gauge gravity duality. Gives us a new window on strong dynamics. A lot of the SUSY breaking dynamics seems to be strong dynamics. Maybe it gives us new ideas for SUSY breaking. And I'll do three examples, one in great detail, only because I understand it best, and two in less detail, but that were studied recently by Bach and Aganagich and by Berlinda. So here's an example that puts some flesh on what I was just saying. And I'll do it in some detail, like I said. So, okay, ADS CFT, you know, here's the typical geometry. There's some cone. And in a CFT, kind of by definition, there can be no dynamical SUSY breaking. There's nothing to set the scale, the vacuum energy, there'd be nothing to set the scale of the lifetime, so the lifetime would be zero. Okay. If you try to do anything that breaks SUSY in ADS-CFT, literally, what happens is your SUSY breaking sort of runs off to R equals zero of the deep infrared and disappears. So we can't use ADS-CFT, but we can consider a gravity dual of not quite a CFT. There are different examples by now. The easiest one for me to work with is the one that was studied by Klebanov and a number of collaborators. So let's consider the conifold geometry. Here is the conifold geometry. There are four coordinates z. This looks like a cone over S3 times S2. So there's a sort of picture like this, where both the S3 and S2 collapse if epsilon is zero. If epsilon is non-zero, it gives a finite size to the S3 at the tip. Now, the theory of D brains at the conifold was studied intensively. If you put D3 brains, N of them, and D5 brains, M of them, with M small compared to N, in this geometry, you can write down an exact gravity solution that captures the field theory on these brains, and you can tell a pretty good story about the field theory too that seems in accord with the gravity solution. So the field theory is thought to be the following thing. It's an SUN plus M times SUN theory with bifundamentals. That go between the two group factors. There's an SU2 times SU2 global symmetry, which is also symmetry of the cone, acting on the A's and B's by rotating them on the index 1, 2. And there's a unique superpotential at the single trace level, a unique lowest dimension superpotential you can write down, which is of this schematic form, where the epsilons are there to make everything SU2 squared invariant. So this is not only the lowest dimension thing you can write down that would preserve all the symmetries, it also has the nice feature that when you go to the Coulomb branch, when you try to Higgs the theory, with this superpotential, you precisely get eigenvalues that live on the deformed conifold geometry. So this is pretty decisively the correct superpotential. Now, for n equal to km, for n multiple of m, in other words, there's a very nice story. The QFT undergoes what's called a cascade of Seiberg dualities. Which means, if you start with this theory, I mean, I call this a story because with this superpotential in a conformal theory, we know that these things have large anomalous dimensions. So I'm talking about objects that are strongly coupled, and I'm trying to make semi-classical sense out of what they're doing, and that's probably a bad idea. So the gravity solution is the real content. But I can tell you a story that's nice. Okay, the story is one of these factors is more strongly coupled than the other, the one that has relatively less matter compared to its number of colors. So in this case, the SUN plus M looks like it's going to grow strongly coupled as you flow towards the infrared. When it gets too strongly coupled, you Seiberg dualize. At each step, the duality takes n to n minus m when you just go through the rule. You take SUNC to SUNF minus NC. But it weaves the superpotential invariant in form. The extra meson fields you get in the magnetic dual get a mass term. So there's a story where you start with n plus m and n, then it becomes n and n minus m. And precisely when n is an integer multiple of m, it ends at a step where you just have one SUN factor left. So it ends in a confining SUN theory. And in such a theory, there is a scale. There's at least one scale, a scale set by confinement. And so you can imagine introducing SUSY breaking or anything else with time scales that are long or short compared to that scale. Now, the real story here is gravity. And I guess Arkady is there. And he and Igor wrote down an approximate solution that's going to be good enough for most of my purposes, which is valid far from where the confinement occurs. So I'll write the solution because I'm actually going to deform it a little bit, and it'll be useful to have written down the solution. So it looks like the normal kind of ABS-CFT type metric. There's a warp factor multiplying the Minkowski slices and the Poincaré patch. The same warp factor appears, it's often denoted as h to the 1/2, multiplying the coordinates on the radial direction and some cone. Well, sorry, and some Psaki-Einstein space, which was the base of the cone. And it looks like this. Okay, so what is all this stuff? R you should think of as the radial direction in ADS-CFT. I've written an E psi here. E psi is 1/3 d psi plus cosine theta I d phi I summed over I equals 1 and 2. And the E thetas and E phis are just E theta I and sine phi, sine theta I d phi I. Okay, so this is a mouthful. What's going on? You have this base of the cone, which fancy people call T11. This is a sort of warped product of T11 with Minkowski space. And the thetas and phis are just angular coordinates parametrizing two S2s in the geometry. The psi is some circle fibered over the two S2s. If you're somebody who likes to keep track of objects in the field theory, there's a U1R symmetry in n equals 1 superconformal theories. Psi shifts under the U1R. In this solution, that shift symmetry gets broken in a way that I won't tell you about. Okay, and finally, I should tell you the harmonic function. So this e to the 4a is 27 pi g string n over r to the 4th times n plus a correction that tells you the theory isn't quite conformal. Okay, so if it was just this, with m equals 0, I would have a conformal field theory. This is really just the harmonic function you get from D3 brains at the tip of the cone. This m dependence with a log tells you that each decade you move in energy in the radial direction using scale radius duality, you're effectively shifting the D3 charge by some amount proportional to m. Okay, and that's supposed to be related and is quantitatively related in a way that you could work out to the story I told here where n shifts by m units as you flow towards the infrared. Okay, then there's a bunch of other fields. I mean, type 2b has a dilaton. You can set it to be a constant. The five-form field strength is related to the same harmonic function. That's 1 plus the Hodge star for self-duality times minus 27 pi times n plus this log. Okay, times the volume of the cone. And there are three-form fluxes, and I'm getting tired of writing out stuff, so I won't write them out. Okay, so there are also three-form fluxes, which I could tell you. So that's interesting. This is the solution that Zeitlin and Igor wrote down years ago. It preserves SU2 times SU2. Now, there's a second regime in the solution that they didn't write down, but that Igor wrote down later with Strasbourg, and that will be relevant for half of what I do. This will be relevant for the other half, which is the solution near the tip, where the SUM theory lives, where chiral symmetry breaks, where all the infrared dynamics happens. And this solution is wonderfully simple. So it looks like this. The geometry is basically just going to be an S3. It would have been small if there was really a barely deformed conifold, but the warp factor plumps it up. So here's what it looks like. So what is this? There's a warp factor. This is in the solution with a given K and M. e to the minus k over m. So it can be exponentially large with modest choices of g and k. There's a three-form field strength that penetrates the three-sphere that remains finite at the tip. So epsilon is the volume form on this S3 that remains finite at the tip. The size of the S3 is of order gm. It's large in the supergravity regime. And this little constant f is chosen to make this thing integrate to give m units of flux over the three-sphere. So it's 2 over some powers of g and m. And finally, b-naught is some number that's like 0.93. Okay, what am I going to do with this geometry? What I'm going to do here is try to figure out a way to break SUSY that takes advantage of the fact that this theory has a tiny scale built into it, the scale a-naught, that came out of this long RG running. And then I'll go back and try to figure out what that means in this distance geometry and how you'd capture that SUSY breaking by doing holographic computations at infinity, where you read off vacuum energies. So again, although this is pretty sophisticated stuff, if you're sort of a naive, stupid string theorist, and you just look at this and you say, gee, SUSY QCD has metastable states, and this thing kind of looks like SUSY QCD, can you make something here that breaks SUSY? There's a really stupid idea that occurs to you following the work of people like Joe and Matt Strasser, which is you could just add some D3 probes. Well, if they were D3 probes, they'd have a moduli space and they wouldn't break SUSY. But you could add D3 bar probes. And there's a number P. So to get control, you could work in some regime like that. This has nothing to do with field theory ideas. This is an idea that would never occur to you if you hadn't learned string theory. Okay, that doesn't mean it's useful for nature, but it's certainly a stringy idea. So you can now consider their dynamics in two different ways. First is probes, which I'll describe here, and then in terms of their back reaction on the long-distance solution. So what is the probe dynamics? Well, first of all, because they're anti-D3 brains in a geometry made at the start from three brains, which have now all disappeared, they feel a potential. And that potential you calculate by taking the DBI action and sticking it in first to this metric. Then you realize they'll be drawn to the regime where this metric isn't valid, and you put it in to this metric. Okay. So what happens is that at large R, you stick that potential in, you stick that metric in flux in, and you'll see these things are attracted to the tip by a phi to the fourth potential. Okay, it's a trivial thing to do. Now at the tip, Rob Myers is sitting right there. So at the tip, the Myers effect happens. So you can go to Rob's paper that studies zero grains in flux backgrounds, and you can sort of t-dualize it very roughly. And what you find happens is the following. So you have this big S3. You have m units of flux piercing this big S3. And you have sort of p anti-brains that are sort of sitting here. You can check that they actually like to attract each other, so they'll be sitting on top of each other. And this Myers effect says if you expand out the effective potential for the non-abelian SUP fields in the presence of this flux, you get new terms. So there's a term that just corresponds to the brain tension. Okay. There is a term that's directly proportional to the amount of three-form flux, F epsilon ijk, multiplying trace phi I, phi j, phi k. And then there's a term that looks like the commutator squared. And higher order terms. Okay, so what's going on? This brain tension is what you'd expect. Okay, it's just the leading order tension of the brains. In fact, it's warped. So there are powers of a-naught in it that I suppressed here because a-naught multiplies everything. This term is the term that you're used to from n equals 4 Yang Mills. It would give a moduli space that has these commuting matrices. And the cubic term, which I wrote on two different lines, is what's induced by the interaction with the 3 form. So I, J, and K here just run over the directions on the S3. Now, given that potential, it's pretty clear there's not going to be a moduli space for these things, even at the tip, except maybe any moduli that are left as Goldstone bosons. So instead, the potential is going to fix these phi fields in some way. And this is precisely the way that I think Rob discovered first. So there are minima where geometrically what's happening is the brains expand. The phis get a VEV that's sort of non-abelian and sweeps out a fuzzy sphere inside the S3. So in fact, where are these minima? If you derive the equations from that potential, the cubic term would give you a, well, OK. So you have to derive those equations and then stare at an ansatz and convince yourself that the ansatz satisfies the equations. Okay. But the ansatz that satisfies the equations coming from that potential is that two of the phi matrices should commute to give the third. Now, you've all seen this before, other than the annoying factors of G string and F, right? I mean, you can rescale phi to get rid of the annoying factors because the equation's not homogeneous. And so you actually get a critical point for each SU2 representation of dimension P. Now, not all those critical points are minima. There is one that's the lowest energy guy and that is a minimum. There's a minimal energy configuration is the irrep of dimension P. And for P much less than M, this configuration is metastable. The geometry is it's a 2-sphere inside the 3-sphere whose radius is given by this formula. For P much less than M, using the 3-brain probe action was the right thing because they're not very much of a 5-brain. It's still a small 2-sphere in the 3-sphere. For P much larger than that, you should switch to using a 5-brain action, and you'll find that, in fact, metastability is lost when P is not much less than M.
Why don't you just take K equals 1 and stick it upon the throne and be done with it?
You could do that, but then I wouldn't get to talk about the Myers effect. Yeah, I agree. P equals 1 would certainly work, and there would be none of this other stuff. You just go to the end of the throne. Okay. So the result, after all this discussion, is in the open string probe approximation, a metastable Susie breaking state in this theory whose energy is going to be P TD3 e to the minus 8 pi k over 3GM, which is much smaller than M string before, in any regime where you can use supergravity. Now, why am I calling it a metastable Susie breaking state as opposed to just a theory that has explicitly broken supersymmetry? There are two reasons. Here's one obvious reason I'm calling it that. It's that there exists a Susie state with the same charges as this non-supersymmetric state, and to which you can write down an instanton that will mediate decay. That's the Susie state that has M minus P, N minus P, D3 brains, the same flux in the A cycle of the conifold, but a changed NS3 flux. So I don't really want to describe the decay to this state in any detail, but it's supersymmetric. And this state can decay to that state by a known instanton that you can write down in the geometry. Now, there's another reason I'm calling this a state, which is that I'm going to write down the large distance gravity solution. And we'll see that it differs from a supersymmetric solution by normalizable terms. Oops. Which in ADS-CFT means that it should be interpreted as a state in the theory from which it differs by the normalizable terms. Okay, So anyway, our conclusion right now is that this conical gauge theory has Susy breaking states at large M and N. And it should be pretty clear, as you know, as was true with the field theory examples I did at the start, although I talked here about the conifold and rely heavily on all kinds of work that Igor did with many people, in fact, everything I said geometrically seems likely to be true in other examples of theories that confine at a small scale and have gravity duals. So anytime you have a tip of some cone that deforms, some of the Delpezzo cascades and so forth, you could probably do the same thing.
In the first example, I identified it with field theory, you had to add a small mass parameter by hand.
Yeah.
You haven't had to add a small parameter by hand here.
No, you haven't had to add a small parameter by hand here. But there, I mean, there's a P over M expansion. So you could say there's a large integer.
Okay.
If not exponentially.
It's not hierarchical.
It's not, yeah, that's right. You don't add a small parameter in that sense. But again, this is all non-compact, and once you compactify, you have to worry about stabilizing everything, and that gets us into
storage. But into whatever in the gauge theory is dual to this.
In the gauge theory dual to this, you didn't have to add a small parameter. That's right. Okay, I should say relatives exist that Sebastian understands much better than me. If you just take sort of geometries that generalize the conifold, and these have the interesting property that they have ISS states at weak coupling. They seem to have D3 bar states at strong coupling, and the two may actually be related to each other on extrapolation. That's an uncontrolled statement, because with a metastable state, as you crank up the coupling, you leave the regime of computability, it may decay. It could be that there are both sets of states, but they're unrelated in any real way. But there's an interesting correspondence for n greater than 2 between these geometries that have both ISS states, and where you can make states like this. Okay. So now let's ask about the long distance solution. So our philosophy here is that for anything relating to the holographic map, all that you need in ADS-CFT is the data at infinity. And so you can take Klebanov and Zeitlin and start to poke them and ask them to break supersymmetry and see where you get. And so we were able to find a solution that does this, that looks like the following thing. And again, what's interesting is not the details, but what it tells you about how the canonical solutions will probably deform when you break Susy. So what are we doing? We're writing down a more general metric on SOTS. This theory, a priori, could have different warp factors for the circle fiber direction and the two spheres as compared to the Minkowski directions. And at leading order, in a small parameter, which in the microscopic solution should be identified with P e to the minus 8 pi k over 3gm with the warped brain tension, you can write down a solution that determines these functions e to the a, e to the b, e to the c, and all the fluxes in such a way that you recover the expected vacuum energy while asymptoting to the same supersymmetric asymptotics. So what you find is this. So what's interesting here is not so much the details as what's qualitatively different. There have been changes to the deltan, to the metric, and to the three-form fluxes. They're all kind of interesting. And qualitatively, what the solution has done is the following. So we started off with a cone over T11, and even in the KS solution, you preserve the symmetry between the circle fiber direction and the two spheres. But here, the T11 is squashed. So the circle is now squashed relative to the size of the two spheres. That's some geometric terrible thing you've done to this formerly nice space. The flux, for those of you who are experts in flux compactification, it's usual for people to talk about imaginary self-dual fluxes. Here, there's a 1-2 Hodge type non-ISD flux that is sourced by a Suzy breaking. And the dilaton, which is often constant, is now running logarithmically. Now, the nice thing about all of these perturbations is that they occur in an expansion in S over R to the fourth, which means that they're normalizable. So these are all normalizable, and you can go to some awfully difficult paper that Ofer wrote with Alex Bushell and read off the gauge gravity dictionary for these cascading theories, which is not exactly the same as the one in ADS, and translate all these things into VEBs of various operators in this sort of fictitious field theory that we pretend is dual to the geometry. Okay.
The fiber got squished.
Well, R symmetry is actually broken in various ways in the solution that I didn't discuss. I'd be happy. Okay, so what could you possibly use this for? I mean, what you could use this for is the same thing people do in field theory, except now with geometry. So you see, given such a thing, you have a picture where there's some throat and there's Suzy breaking, and you have a solution. You can now pretend that whatever you're planning to do to make the standard model moves a little bit into this throat, and it feels the Suzy breaking via these normalizable modes, and you can try to compute soft terms or make composite models or do other fun things, which we're trying to do. Okay, so that was me selfishly explaining some of my own work. Let me talk about other brainy ideas, which I will explain in cartoons. But I think the cartoons get across the idea, if not the details. Yeah.
I'm sorry, before you go on, I want to understand your work a little bit better. So first of all, the asymptotics here approaches the supersymmetric state with the flux n minus p.
Yeah. It's not the flux n in which you put the probes. It's a different flux.
It's the corrected one.
It's the corrected flux.
Okay. And now, you found the solution by just solving the equations asymptotically.
Yes.
Right? So what... I want to know what sort of told you that you had this sort of anti-brain in the...
Yeah, no, okay, good. Here, I want to say one thing, which is a general cautionary tale for this kind of thing, which I weren't actually from Polchinski-Strassler, but, you know, if you take these solutions and you look at linearized perturbations, you could write down a huge family of non-supersymmetric normalizable deformations, no problem, hundreds of them. Yeah. Okay, what would go wrong is that when you actually tried to continue all the way to the tip, where there was in KT a naked singularity, well, Pavlov-Strassler resolves that, but it will not resolve that for all choices of the hundreds of Suzy-breaking perturbations. What we did instead is say, well, look, we futzed around at the tip, we wrote down something that seems to correspond to real sources in the theory, real anti-D3 brains. So that ought to source some long-distance solution. Let's try to find a solution that, with the sort of minimal field content, captures the existence of a non-zero vacuum energy and a certain VEV for some operator that we think ought to be turned on, and see whether, with that kind of ansatz, we can find any solution. And in this Aharoni et al. Formalism, we actually found a unique solution that could source the required tension up to this parameter S. Okay? Did they answer your question?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So what are the other brainy ideas? Okay, one brainy person is Herman Rolinda, and he had the following very simple geometrical idea. Again, not something that would occur to you as a field theorist, but something that looks very natural in string theory. So let's imagine you have a brain on some curve C. So it's a phi brain. And let's actually say that C, I don't know, because Delpezzos are so popular, let's say C lives in a Delpezzo surface. That's not essential, but that way I get to say Delpezzo. And let's say that C is cohomologically non-trivial within that surface. But let's say that globally in the Calabi-Yau threefold, C is the boundary of some sigma where sigma is not in the Delpezzo, right? It extends out into the bulk of the Calabi-Yau. So there's a picture that you can then draw. Here's C. Here's my artist's rendition of sigma. And the idea is, in some such circumstances, for which you need to know a little bit of information actually about the metric, although C is globally contractible, it requires you to first increase the volume as you try to contract it along the cycle sigma which bounds it. So locally, to small fluctuations, this phi Brainon C, or whatever more fancy object it is in the drive category if you're a very small radius, okay, would actually need to fluctuate up in energy before it can unwind. This is a state that's metastable not for a topological reason, but for a geometric reason. It's geometrically stable. And he gave some examples of such things in non-compact geometries. Okay, this is a very simple idea. There's a relative of this idea. So this is Verlinde. There's another relative, which is, I think, Aganovich and Vafa. I might get the credits wrong, I'm not quite sure. And their idea is, well, we have brains and anti-brains, so we could even have C be topologically non-trivial. And in fact, there could be more than one representative of C sitting in the Calabi-Yau. The Quintic, for instance, has 2,875 rational curves of degree 1. They're generally isolated for choices of complex structure. And so there, you know, there are 2,800 of these things. I'm about to complain about that in a second. Okay. So well, if this is the picture, so they're isolated holomorphic curves, they could move into each other, but only by fattening the volume to weave holomorphic curves. Well, then if you put a D-brain here and an anti-D-brain here, again, for a string theorist, this is, it's like playing with Tinker Toys. It's obvious. The field theory description of this is some hideous thing. Okay? Now, the problem with these ideas, these are great ideas. To my taste, you would need to combine with something like warping to get something where the Suzy breaking tension or energy is much less than the string scale. The natural brain tensions are M strings over G. And to get a very small scale, you'd have to take one of these nice ideas and then, you know, warp the Del Pezzo or whatever. And so I described the other thing first. But I, you know, these seem perfectly natural as ideas. I still have 6 minutes. So in the last 6 minutes, I'll go back to what Eva said at the start. Okay, so D brains are great. We just saw, combined with the effects they generate in warping or the fluxes they source, they lead to geometric ideas for Suzy breaking. They do one other thing. In addition to being sort of actors that live in space-time, they are actors that can wrap Euclidean world sheets in the extra dimensions. Okay, there can be D-brain versions of world sheet instantons. So there certainly exist non-compact geometries. Where a simple quiver gauge theory that arises at some singularity plus a stringy effect, which comes from Euclidean D-brain, can lead to DSB without any non-abelian gauge dynamics. And in fact, the simplest examples would go back to the start of this lecture, write down the Polonian phi models, but actually obtain the mu parameter there, or the m parameter in the phi model, from a stringy effect. Now, of course, there the small parameter is just a parameter. In the non-compact geometry, the parameter is a parameter. In a compact geometry, you'd have to stabilize it. So you could worry about that. But at the level of, how to say, moral sophistication then, it puts things like the Polonyi model on the same footing as the field theory DSB models. There's an exponentially small effect, not governed by dimensional transmutation, but by small g-string. So here's an example. I understand that Timo Wiegand, our colleague at Stanford, gave a talk about string instantons here 2.5 weeks ago. So I will not talk about any technical details. I will just give an example. Okay. So consider the following Hanani-Witten type setup. I could T-dualize it to a type 2B brain construction, but I think Hanani is here. So, for those of you who didn't live through this era in physics, you specify the brains by giving a big list of the dimensions that they wrap. So we have some NS brains and some NS prime brains that are orthogonal to each other in a certain set of directions, and some parallel NS brains. And we can stretch a D4 brain between the parallel NS5 brains on the 0, 1, 2, 3, 6 directions. That gives you a U1 gauge theory. There's a D4 brain gauge boson that has a kinetic term that's much smaller than the kinetic terms that move the NS5 brains around. This is T dual to some brain wrapping a cycle in a Calabi-Yau. Now, if you choose the NS prime brain, and in particular, an O6 plane, just right, where just right was explained in Timo's talk, you get the following quiver gauge theory. It's a quiver with two nodes, because you could imagine a D4 stretched here, and there you can imagine D4 stretched here. So here's how I'm going to draw the quiver. There's an adjoint field for this thing, because it can move up and down on the NS brains, which are parallel to each other. So there's some field X. I'll call these nodes 1 and 2, and I'll just put one D4 brain here. So there's a U1 gauge theory with an adjoint of U1, also known as a singlet. Now, in this quiver, in fact, if you did put a D brain here, which I haven't, there would be, roughly speaking, strings that go like this that would give you a flavor and anti-flavor. This is old Hanani Wittenology. So in the quiver for space-filling brains, there would be arrows like that. I added an O-plane in such a way that if there were a space-filling brain here, instead of an SU gauge group, I would get the exciting SP gauge group. Okay, but other than that, it's just a product SU theory with bifundamentals. Now, if you imagine putting a brain here or letting a Euclidean brain move here, it's rigid. Unlike this guy, which can slide up and down on the NS brains, the fact that the NS prime and NS aren't parallel means that that motion modulus is gone. Okay. So there exists a rigid instanton that can wrap node 1. Of course, you should sum over all instantons, not just that rigid guy. But that's one of the guys. You can ask what it does. Well, by a simple translation of the fact that you have these quark flavors here in the geometry with a real D4 there, you in fact find that there are fermionic strings, first discussed by Ganor, that stretch between the instanton and the space-filling brain. So you end up, this instanton has the normal R4 collective coordinates that let it move around, and it has charged collective coordinates under the U1 gauge group that lives here. Okay, just like the quarks that would have stretched here would too. Now, you can just write down what kinds of terms such an instanton, which will have the right number of zero modes if there's the O-plane here, two, would contribute to the superpotential. It would contribute something that looks like e to the minus area over the curve it wraps, geometrized here as a distance, times an integral over the collective coordinates, which now includes an integral d alpha d beta, and there's an interaction, alpha x beta, that's the same interaction that would have been there for the quarks, had they existed between this D4 and this D4. Okay, and this is a simple translation of Rolle calculations to the case where you change four boundary conditions. So what this would give you is a delta W that's e to the minus area times x with dimensions made up by m string. Now, what is that? Well, this is a Polonyi model. This is an instanton effect deforming the superpotential of the Polonyi model, and it's exponentially small because there is an e to the minus area here. Okay? So at the same level that you can find some field theory where non-perturbative effects generate small parameters, in string theory you can even take the sort of stupidest models, the Polonyi and Faye models, and arrange geometries where they themselves will dynamically be what's called retrofitted by Eva and Mike Dine. So here, I should say two other things before I close. You can do the same with the Rafferty models or with Faye models or whatever you like in this non-compact geometry. And in fact, geometric transitions, if you're somebody who likes to have exact formulas, in these non-compact cases allow you to, in fact, so here I just wrote down one instanton. I liked this instanton. It did something that I like. You could have worried about other instantons. In exactly these geometries, you can perform geometric transitions and just sum all the instantons. So you can see what they do. You can verify which approximations are good and which ones aren't as you vary the norm of the area. Okay, but nothing changes compared to what I said here. So my conclusion here is, in string theory, maybe the old pre-DSB guys will win in the end, like point. But I don't know. So that was a review. I went 1 minute over, sorry.
What remains to be done? Is the challenge on the stringy side finding compact models that are compact, or?
No, okay. So there should have been two other 90-minute lectures delivered by other people. There should be a 90-minute lecture on how you would take some system like this and put it in a Calabi-Yau in a way that the SUSY breaking scales don't all run off. I personally like the anti-breaks, it introduces less scales. But anyway, for these models, you have to end up stabilizing the size of this node. For these models, while typically in the quintic there are 2,800 isolated curves, for certain complex structures they run together in a moduli space. What this would do when you compactify it is, in fact, first roll to those complex structures, then these guys would just perturbatively annihilate. So this all does tie up in a deep way with how you're going to compactify, and that's a very model-dependent and difficult issue. Okay, so that's some other subject I didn't touch on. A second subject I didn't touch on, which is also great for string theorists to think about, is mediation. Okay, mediation of SUSY breaking. Because if they find anything like low energy SUSY at the LHC, it will tell us probably absolutely nothing about how SUSY broke. Okay, maybe we'll get the scale out of it. But what it may well tell us is what kind of interactions mediated between the sector that broke SUSY and the standard model. Okay, the first question you could ask is, how do we know there's another sector? And the answer to that is, if you make reasonable assumptions about the SUSY breaking, you can prove that if SUSY broke directly in the standard model, there would be a scalar wider than the up or down quark. So we know there's a hidden sector that broke SUSY under reasonable assumptions. But it may have been communicated to us by random dimension 6 Planck swap. That's called gravity mediation, or maybe gauge mediation. There are other ideas like anomaly mediation that are even more UV sensitive than dimension 6 Planck swap. So all of those things, to really be made into theories, do require input from the UV, except gauge mediation. Okay, gauge mediation does not, but anomaly mediation does, gravity mediation does, gauge ENO mediation. There are all kinds of models that phenomenologists have that really will be tested by the LHC, whereas the breaking sector won't. And a lot of those ideas I think we can kill, or we can try to find the particular corners where they work. But that's another 90-minute lecture.
For the gauge
gravity
ones, did you end up packaging the
CD
breaking in terms of some usual F and D terms, or was it
not like that? Yeah, so I would say that it's distressingly difficult to give a very convincing packaging. One of the reasons is, so you can of course read off all the VEVs of operators, okay? But let's take the conical gauge theory, okay? This is some simple theory. It has the super potential I told you, AB. And it also has two marginal gauge couplings. Okay, there's a 1 over G1 squared, F squared, and a 1 over G2 squared, F squared, for the SUN and SUN plus N factors. So a priori, this theory looks like it has three marginal operators in this and the plus and minus combinations of the two gauge couplings. In fact, two of them, two complex combinations, are exactly marginal operators in the conformal limit. Okay. And what really happens, as you guess, is since they all preserve the same symmetries, they mix. So when you read off auxiliary BEVs, if you use any sort of approximation to the map, since these things are mixing with these things, D terms live here and F terms live here, it's very hard to extract, given that you know some combination has a BEV, whether it's the F term here or the D term here. There's an invariant question you can ask, which is probably the better question other than F and D term, which is U1R broken by a new order parameter? Okay, D term breaking will never do that. F term breaking sometimes does, sometimes doesn't, like an ISS. And in this theory, I know that there is not a new U1R breaking parameter. But that could mean that it's like ISS, where it's F term but preserves a U1, or it could mean that it's D term.
So, okay, that's related to the gauge-ENO.
Yeah.
So are there examples of the non-breaking F term, D term, where you can see them morph into one another in field theory?
You mean where you can see F and D term breaking morph into each other?
Yeah.
I asked Nadi this question. There's a tiny bit of D term and a big F term. In the regime where you can calculate it. But they
it's two discrete regimes, correct? Two regimes that are with transition between them, right?
Well, if you take R through, which model?
The F I model.
The one that I showed, it breaks SUSY for any value of R. There's a different version of it that breaks SUSY only for R positive and restores for R negative.
Yeah.
That's a model where it is, in fact, pure D term breaking. but I don't know how to get that model to morph into.
Sure, you can go, as you say, the Big Bad is at that large R.
In the model, I just appear Big Bad is at.
Yeah. Okay, so it's really not such a distinction there.
I'm kind of convinced that unless you have a Phi Eliopoulos term in a strongly coupled theory, there may not be an invariant distinction. Because what the Gugino is and what the other fermions are, the question is, what's the Goldsteino? Is it the Gugino or something else?
Yeah.
And if there's no weakly coupled gauge multiple and weakly coupled matter multiple, you're not asking a question. So you can identify the Goldsteino, but to put it in a weakly coupled multiple can be hard.
Other questions? I don't see further questions, so thanks again.